I'm Ron Elving.
I'm Ken Rudin.
I'm international film and television star Nick Searcy, but you already knew that.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm still Ken Rudin. And Ron, I think the listener needs to know why we started the podcast with Nick Searcy.
Well, because of Yellow Flowers. Yellow Flowers is sweeping the country, or are sweeping the country,
whichever you prefer. Not Baby Fish Mouth?
Not Baby Fish Mouth. Let's just say that the strangest two ads ever made in the history of American politics were both made and aired this very week, but not on television. So don't run to your television to see these ads. They're available only through the internets.
The internets. There are two commercials promoting the candidacy of Herman Cain.
And smoking.
And smoking, because, the way we're interpreting it, everybody's interpreting it.
He says, I smoke. It's a choice. He blows smoke in your face.
That's Mark Block, the chief of staff for Herman Cain, Inc. But as it turned out, Herman Cain used to be a lobbyist for the National Restaurant Association, which fought smoking bans.
Well, of course they did, because the restaurateurs didn't want to have to ban smoking in their restaurants.
Right.
It was enough of a problem having two sections and so on. And, of course, now it's been done and people have all adjusted to it and it doesn't seem to have been that big a deal.
You mentioned that just in the nick of time.
And these ads...
I loved your face just then. And
these ads have everybody talking about Herman Cain, but everybody was already talking about Herman Cain because he's number one in just about every poll being done nationally.
That's right. And locally, statewide as well. Of course, the new one is CBS.
Not in New Hampshire and South Carolina.
But in the very important state of Ohio, he's leading Mitt Romney as well. That's the thing. Most of us, or part of us, or part of me, dismissed his performance in the last debate. Herman Cain's debate performance, because in the first 20 minutes, I thought his 999 plan and the whole argument for it was ripped apart by all the candidates.
Every last one.
And so these new polls, the CBS New York Times poll that shows him with a clear lead, a clear front runner, love that word, don't we? And in other words, it already had to have taken into effect what happened in the debates.
These are all polls that have been taken since that debate, in which his response to all of these attacks was, that's incorrect, and that was all he had to say.
You can look it up on my website.
Yeah, look it up on my website. So all I can say is the Herman Cain phenomenon, which we have not really been able to explain or get our arms around entirely, except that it's a rejection of the candidate field. People still don't like Mitt Romney, even though they're increasingly realizing he's probably going to be their nominee.
Although his numbers have not improved.
Numbers have not improved. On the other hand, he's starting to get those endorsements from Congress and other office holders that essentially indicate that these people expect him to eventually be the nominee. And I expect, this being the Republican Party, that even if they don't fall in love with him, eventually they will fall in line. That's what they tend to do.
That's true. Well, of course, we both agree that this is a different Republican Party than we've seen in the past. One example, there's a possibility that the argument for a flat tax, which didn't do Steve Forbes any good in 1996, might somehow rescue Rick Perry candidacy.
I think the flat tax is appealing, whether it comes from Herman Cain in his 999 plan or whether it comes from Rick Perry, mostly because it sounds simpler. And people like the idea of the postcard return instead of the complicated return. Everyone would like that idea. The problem is that the more you learn about the flat tax, the more you start doing your own personal calculation, you see that it delivers by far the bulk of its benefit to the higher income brackets, the wealthy, and that automatically means more income disparity. That automatically means that the average Republican, or certainly Tea Party person, is going to do the calculation and say, hey, maybe that's not better for me at some point or another. We've got a long way to go before the voting starts.
Not as long as and we'll talk about the new calendar in a minute because I think it's now firmed up. But there still seems to be this disconnect between we smart people in Washington who seems to know, we're convinced,
us smart people in Washington.
Rick Perry versus Mitt Romney. And yet the voters, if you look at polls again, and again, we keep saying, do not write off Rick Perry. And, he does have money, we think. He does have new people added to his staff, Joe Albaugh, the former FEMA?
Yes, he was the FEMA director after he had been part of the Iron Triangle that ran the George W. Bush juggernaut in 2000.
Right.
And they were considered to be very good. Karen Hughes, Karl Rove, who's gone on to be the most famous, of course, and Joe Albaugh, who was the operative manager of the campaign. He was the guy who kept the campaign running on schedule.
So why are we insisting that Rick Perry is the alternative here when certainly the voters voters are not, or at least the prospective voters are not.
We're insisting on that because we have been watching politics for a long time, and what we expect to see at some point or another is that the candidate with money, who has already taken the blows, taken the inspection that comes with running at this level, and has still survived to this point, will eventually become the default, not the loved, but the default alternative to Mitt Romney, who is himself the default but not loved alternative to Barack Obama. And so the Republicans will sort themselves out in that fashion. And at some point or another, they're going to stop and say, do I really want Herman Cain to be my president? What do I really know about this guy? And in the next few weeks, we're going to continue to learn more and more about him. And the suspicion among people who do this for a living is that he will not survive that scrutiny.
Well, here's another perfect example. Last week on CNN, Herman Cain sat down for this interview with Piers Morgan. And we know that Herman Cain is steadfast against abortion, even in cases of rape or incest. He's always said that. He said that when he ran for the Senate in Georgia in 2004. And yet, in this interview, in this CNN interview, he basically is endorsing what seems to me a pro-choice position.
It ultimately gets down to a choice that that family or that mother has to make. Not me as president.
Yes, and that confused a lot of people. And I believe that the more that he gets scrutiny, the more he will confuse a lot of people. And this bloom will come off the rose at some point or another. But for the moment, he is the place you go to express your dissatisfaction with the Republican candidates, especially if you're a Tea Party person. A lot of people in the Tea Party do not like Mitt Romney. They have been unimpressed by Rick Perry, particularly those policies we've talked about in the past, the immigration issue and some of the HPV. So they're looking around, and they've seen a lot of Newt Gingrich. They've seen enough of Rick Santorum.
Michelle Bachmann was
exactly like Herman Cain is today, but 3 or 4 months ago, she didn't survive those 3 or 4 months. And again, one is betting neither will Herman Cain. If we're wrong, this will be a historic moment. Two African Americans running against each other for president of the United States.
When was the last time that happened? Before we leave Herman Cain completely, I don't have a URL in front of me, but you just go on to Google and search Herman Cain and Smoking Man and Herman Cain Yellow Flowers.
Yellow Flowers is even more extraordinary than Smoking Man. But we should let the listener look at these because we really can't describe these ads. And ads they are. They end with a picture of Herman Cain smiling into the camera, and they are direct pitches that the campaign totally acknowledges. These are not hoaxes,
right?
But you'll need to remind yourself of that as you watch these ads.
And as you get high before you watch these ads. It reminds me, there's something about the Demon Sheep ad,
yes,
for Carly Fiorina in 2010.
Attacking
Tom Campbell. And the first time I watched it, I said, you've got to be kidding. And yet it was, I couldn't take my eyes off it. And I've watched it many times. As a matter of fact, I have dreams about sheep. Matter of fact, I started drinking Woolite just the other night.
Yes, and it's bad when you get to that point.
Yes.
I would just like to say that the Bachmann campaign has been trying to recover from her recent miscues and, of course, the resignation of her entire New Hampshire staff, but she has replaced those people, and she is doggedly fighting on. So we should not dismiss Michelle Bachmann yet. It's possible that if Herman Cain should crash and burn, perhaps some of this Tea Party enthusiasm will come back to her.
Well, if we're back to the top two, the media's decision, the media's speculation of the top two, it's Mitt Romney and Rick Perry. Rick Perry announced this week that maybe he shouldn't have been involved in all these debates, that it was probably not a good thing for his campaign.
Yes, I think he should not have been involved in the first, say, four.
Exactly, or the first five, perhaps. And he said he'd rather do retail campaigning. He complained that what the debates make you do is they make you attack your rivals.
That'd be terrible.
And because, you know, we know that Rick Perry doesn't like to attack his rivals, that Governor K. Bailey Hutchison will tell you.
Yeah, that's right, Governor Hutchison. So is this just a trial balloon? I mean, I can't believe that Perry is really going to drop out of the debates. He might get a little more selective and just do major states or something like that, or maybe he'll decide he doesn't want to do the Oregon debate in March, you know, if he's still in the running.
This is a debate sponsored by Oregon Public Broadcasting, scheduled for March 19th. Ron Elving, I ask you, when was the last time that there was a legitimate and genuine battle for the Republican nomination as late as March 19th? What year would you say?
1980.
That is correct. 1980. Not since then has there been a battle that
Absolutely
long.
Absolutely not. Not even close, really. I mean, Bob Dole wrapped it up the first weekend or second week, rather, of March in 1996. And really, the Republicans don't like having a long, protracted contest. That has not been their style. On the other hand, this year they have proportional representation in the early events.
Before April, right.
So that we could get some distribution of the votes. It's not going to be winner take all.
But you know why they do it?
And we also have some regional disparity of appeal among the candidates, so it's possible we'll get a guy who's the Southern candidate and a guy who's a candidate of the other states.
We talk about how the Republicans have always been opposed to this long battle. They like it to be neat and tidy and wrapped up early. But what happened in 2008, while Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were going at it for months and months and months, and John McCain wrapped it up early, nobody talked about McCain for months. He disappeared from the newspapers, from the media coverage, and the whole story was about Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and I think the Republicans suffered because of that.
That's very possible, although it's also possible that just the Hillary versus Obama contest was so inherently interesting, they suffered from that. This time around, fundraising has changed. The whole fundraising scheme has changed. It's much more possible for the Republican nominee to remain visible on the air by dint of the efforts of American Crossroads or some other group that can raise money and spend money and keep him on the air even after the nomination has been wrapped up. So that may just be a dead dynamic. We may just see the possibility of ads going straight through the year and no interruption, even after the nomination has been decided.
At least we know now when the nomination battle begins. And that was a decision this week by the Nevada Republican Party, deciding that January 14th encroached into New Hampshire. They were getting tremendous criticism from
a lot of pushback.
A lot of pushback from the RNC, from the Republican candidates, saying that they would boycott Nevada, showing them in solidarity with New Hampshire. So Nevada now goes from January 14th to February 4th, the caucuses, which will enable New Hampshire any day now to announce its primary date as January 10th, a full week after Iowa, and that's the schedule.
So we're set. We have broken the logjam. We know when the first five are going to be, and that pretty much sets the campaigning schedule targets.
For the record, because there are people there, there's a listener with notes.
January 3rd is Iowa caucuses.
January 10th is New Hampshire.
Then on January 21st, we'll have South Carolina.
Which is a Saturday, and then
31st, which is the last Tuesday in the month, we'll have Florida.
And then Nevada, correct.
All right, on February 4th. And that's a better way other than having them all leaping into December. Ugh. I think that would have been very unpopular.
And while Perry took flack for you know waffling about a debate, there's a waffle charge against Mitt Romney, and basically that's on the SB 5 issue number 2 in Ohio about the curtailing of public employee rights in the state there.
Now, SB 5 is actually the law that was passed in Ohio curtailing collective bargaining rights for public employees.
By the Republican legislature and signed by Governor John Kasich.
And so issue number 2 is the repeal
correct
of SB 5.
Which is leading overwhelmingly in the
surprisingly
polls.
Yeah. A lot surprisingly.
Of an energized labor, energized Democratic base battling this.
All right. And so here's Mitt Romney into the state. Everybody knows about this issue. They don't care about politics at all. And when he's asked about it at a phone bank that he had gone to visit, he says, well, I'm not really familiar with these propositions, but I know I support Governor Kasich and the Republican Party. And that was not exactly a bolstering of the supporters of SB 5. It really was not what they were hoping to hear. Is it going too far to say, as I suspect some are saying, that what's going on in Ohio, this pushback from the Democrats, this resistance to the loss of collective bargaining rights for public employees, is in some way related to the energy we see with Occupy Wall Street in the past couple of weeks and to a growing realization that has been fed by a couple of new reports out of Washington this week, particularly the one from the Congressional Budget Office saying that income inequality has grown in America over the last 30 years, has grown since Ronald Reagan became president.
Let's be honest, it started in 1979, so we could say the last 2 years of Jimmy Carter, but certainly the last 30 years.
And to say that changes in government policy, tax cuts and changes in who gets transfer payments, chiefly, of course, more money going to older people who in many cases are more affluent, these have increased the income inequality in contradiction to what supposedly government tax rates and government transfer payments were supposed to do, at least since the New Deal and the Great Society, and that people are coming to realize this and that there is some ferment in general on the left, as there was certainly ferment on the right in 2009 and 2010.
With the Tea Party.
Absolutely.
Exactly. There's some of that. And, of course, we don't know what kind of a pushback there is from the average folk about the Occupy because we keep hearing stories in Oakland, California, and San Francisco that the patience of these municipalities is running thin. And so there obviously there have been some kind of confrontations. There's been some kind of decision to evict. And that could backlash as well because there was an editorial cartoon also this week where you see President Obama marching. We're one of the 99%, mm-hmm. while President Obama is also raising money from Wall Street.
Right.
So we don't know exactly. I mean, there's always been a question of whether the Tea Party benefits the Republicans or not. Certainly it does, but then it will take on the Dick Lugers of the world and perhaps, you know, foment discord within the Republican Party between the establishment and the newer conservatives. And I wonder what this will do to the Democratic coalition.
Exactly.
Well.
Exactly. Will we get an Occupy Wall Street candidate who, like Christine O'Donnell, kept the Republicans from capturing a Senate seat in Delaware that otherwise looked like an absolute slam dunk for them? Will there be instances of that? I wonder if the Democrats wouldn't be willing to give up a couple of those, though, if they felt they could get an equal and opposite push from the people on the left that we see attracted to Occupy Wall Street. The polls this week, at least, this is very ephemeral, but at least for a few days, seem to be indicating that at least a plurality of Americans were pretty open to the message of Occupy Wall Street, and only, you know, a smaller number were ready to say that they were actively opposed. And of course, there were a certain number of people who didn't know what to think of it. But there was more support in things like the Gallup poll for Occupy Wall Street than one would have expected, at least in my imagination politically.
And I don't know if this is connected or not, but I see more and more pressure on the debt committee in Washington having desperately to meet this November 23rd deadline to cut $1.2 trillion from the budget. Now, there was a Democratic proposal this week that really the Republicans dismissed out of hand because, of course, it talks about while you're, you know, savaging Medicare and Medicaid, and a lot of progressives hate that idea as well.
Changing the cost of living adjustment for Social Security, right, which everyone thought would be off the table.
And the Republicans are saying, wait a second, you're still taxing the wealthy, and that's not acceptable. So I don't know how much closer we're getting, but you know that November 23rd is 10 days after
the 13th of November.
My birthday. I just wanted to point that out.
Yes.
But anyway, so there's just, I mean, I don't know if there's a correlation between the growing support for Occupy Wall Street and the frustration that many people have with the inability of Congress to come to something that they've got to accomplish by November 23rd.
Now, I think that these things are in some very loose way all connected. It's certainly not coming in some sort of an organized fashion. It's anything but organized. But there is a connection. Congress's approval rating has fallen all the way into single digits. John McCain made a quip about saying the 9% who still
9%.
Approve are staffers and blood relatives. I personally don't think 9% of the staff of Congress would approve of the job that Congress is doing. And I'm sure not 9% of the members of Congress feel that good about it. So, you know, I stick with the theory that this is a 9% who misunderstood the question.
What was the question?
Particular disapproval attaching to one member of Congress this week because of some revelations about veracity problems about how his family got to the United States.
Well, this is a very interesting story. This is Marco Rubio, who made a big splash on the national scene when, of course, he forced Charlie Crist out of the Republican Party in Florida.
And became the senator from Florida.
Became the senator with, you know, he was like Tea Party before we ever even heard of Tea Party. But part of his narrative always was that his family left Cuba to escape Fidel Castro. Little do we know that they really escaped Fulgencio Batista because they left in 1956, not 1959.
Well, they were escaping Castro the teenager.
Right.
Who was a very ferocious
teenager.
It was
Castro convertible.
That's but they did escape.
So anyway, so I mean, he says that you're deliberately misreading my story. And the story is that my family believed in freedom. They tried to go back to Cuba to attend for a sick relative, then couldn't leave and everything like that. But I kind of think that if the story, which is a great story about how his family left Cuba to escape Castro and
heroic
freedom, heroic again, is it a big deal? Look, if I were the Republican Party, I'd rather this happen now than in Tampa, Florida in September 2012 when nominee Mitt Romney names Marco Rubio as his running mate.
He has been seriously mentioned.
Sure
he's going to have had 2 years in the Senate. He was, as you say, a Tea Party hero before the Tea Party was cool, and he has remade, to some degree, the politics of Florida, or was certainly the symbol of the remaking of those politics. So if he is going to be on the ballot, the scrutiny has only begun for Marco Rubio.
Exactly right. I have a feeling that kids are going to stop yelling his name in swimming pools from now on, which is going to be a big change.
Marco.
Rubio. Another possible running mate is Bobby Jindal, who, not surprisingly, won a landslide second term last Saturday. 66% of the vote against 9 complete unknowns. But I think that's part of the story, the fact that the Democratic Party could not get a single or married
guy to run against him, or woman.
Nobody with any money, with any organization, and a big victory for Bobby Jindal.
Yes, absolutely, and a victory that he really won as much as a year or so ago when it became increasingly clear that no one with any weight would really go after him. Also some comings and goings. John Oliver hanging it up after, what, it must be pretty close to 25 years.
In 1991 came to Congress, and who did he succeed?
Silvio Conti.
Silvio Conti is
correct.
A
Republican.
Ron, I'm very impressed with
you.
I'm
on
today. You are.
Silvio Conti.
Yes, she was great.
And let me just say, he was one of the very few Irish people in Congress.
Silvio Conti. Yes, like patio furniture.
Yes,
another
exactly
one. But John Oliver won a special election when Silvio Conti died in 1991. And this, first of all, he's 75 years old. His wife is suffering from ovarian cancer. And that is the reason he's leaving. And I hate to put it in these political terms, but it solves a problem for Massachusetts Democrats because the Massachusetts Democratic Party controls the entire redistricting process. Massachusetts currently has 10 seats in the House of Representatives.
Going down
to 9. And whom do you get rid of? It's not like you can get rid of a Republican because there are no Republicans. John Oliver, who represents the western part of Massachusetts, the Berkshires.
The geographically largest part.
Did you know I once worked in Camp Lennox in Lee, Massachusetts?
Yes, I did know that because I've read some of the lawsuits.
Yes. Well, so John Oliver leaves. Richard Neal, who is the congressman from, I think, Springfield, will now represent all that district. It solves a problem that Democrats were not looking forward to having to deal with.
That's right. So Richard Neal by a Prius. On the other hand, an older name, one that's been around in Congress for quite a long time and then was absent, is going to try to make a comeback.
We're talking about the manager of the Philadelphia Athletics.
From the 1920s,
right.
Cornelius McGillicuddy.
Exactly. Well, Connie Mack IV.
And, of course, he now legally goes by Connie Mack
right,
IV.
Whose father served two terms in the Senate from Florida, retired in 2000, and then Bill Nelson won the seat. Now Connie Mack IV, who is married, by the way, to Mary Bono, another member of Congress from California. Connie Mack announced this week that he will jump into the Republican race to run against Bill Nelson.
Does she go by Mary Bono Mack?
I think she does. She does. Yeah, she also works for free because she's pro bono.
Pro bono.
Yes.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
I said, Jenny Diver, whoa, Suki Tawdry, look out to Miss Lottie Lenya and old Lucy Brown. Yes, that light.